Part 4. The Tower. 32. Space Express.
"Now don't you say," begged Warren Kingsley, "it'll never get off the ground."
"I was tempted," Morgan chuckled as he examined the full-scale mock-up. "It does look rather like an upended railroad coach."
"That's exactly the image we wanted to sell," Kingsley answered. "You buy your ticket at the station, check in your baggage, settle down in your swivel seat, and admire the view. Or you can go up to the lounge cum bar and devote the next 5 hours to serious drinking until they carry you off at Midway. Incidentally, what do you think of the design section's idea? 19th-century Pullman decor?"
"Not much. Pullman cars didn't have 5 circular floors, one on top of the other."
"Better tell design that. They've set their hearts on gas lighting. If they want an antique flavor, that's a little more appropriate. I once saw an old space movie at the Sydney Art Museum that had a shuttlecraft of some kind with a circular observation lounge. Just what we need."
"Do you remember its name?"
"Oh, let's think. Something like Space Wars 2000. I'm sure you'll be able to trace it."
"I'll tell design to look it up. Now let's go inside. Do you want a hard hat?"
"No,"
answered Morgan brusquely. That was one of the few advantages of being 10 meters shorter than average height. As they stepped into the mock-up, he felt an almost boyish thrill of anticipation. He had checked the designs, watched the computers playing with graphics and layout. Everything here would be perfectly familiar. But this was real, solid. True, it would never leave the ground, just as the old joke said, but one day, its identical brethren would be hurtling up through the clouds and climbing in only 5 hours to Midway Station, 25,000 kilometers from Earth. And all for about $1 worth of electricity per passenger. Even now, it was impossible to realize the full meaning of the coming revolution. For the first time, space itself would become as accessible as any point on the surface of the familiar Earth. In a few more decades, if the average man wanted to spend a weekend on the moon, he could afford to do so. Even Mars would not be out of the question. There were no limitations to what might now be possible. Morgan came back to Earth with a bump as he almost tripped over a piece of badly laid carpet.
"Sorry," said his guide, "another of design's ideas. That green is supposed to remind people of Earth. The ceilings are going to be blue, getting deeper and deeper on the upper floors, and they want to use indirect lighting everywhere so that the stars will be visible."
Morgan shook his head. "That's a nice idea, but it won't work. If the lighting's good enough for comfortable reading, the glare will wipe out the stars. You'll need a section of the lounge that can be completely blacked out."
"That's already planned for part of the bar. You can order your drink and retire behind curtains." They were now standing on the lowest floor of the capsule, a circular room 8 meters in diameter, 3 meters high. All around were miscellaneous boxes, cylinders, and control panels bearing such labels as Oxygen Reserve, Battery, CO2 Cracker, Medical, Temperature Control. Everything was clearly of a provisional, temporary nature, liable to be rearranged at a moment's notice.
"Anyone would think we were building a spaceship," Morgan commented. "Incidentally, what's the latest estimate of survival time?"
"As long as power's available, at least a week, even for a full load of 50 passengers, which is really absurd, since a rescue team could always reach them in 3 hours, either from Earth or from Midway.
Barring a major catastrophe, like damage to the tower or tracks."
"If that ever happens, I don't think there will be anyone to rescue. But if a capsule gets stuck for some reason, and the passengers don't go mad and gobble up all our delicious emergency compressed food tablets at once, their biggest problem will be boredom."
The second floor was completely empty, devoid even of temporary fittings. Someone had chalked a large rectangle on the curved plastic panel of the wall and printed inside it, "Airlock here."
"This will be the baggage room, though we're not sure if we'll need so much space. If not, it can be used for extra passengers. Now, this floor's much more interesting." The third level contained 12 aircraft-type chairs, each of a different design.
Two of them were occupied by realistic dummies, male and female, who looked very bored with the whole proceedings. "We've practically decided on this model," said Kingsley, pointing to a luxurious, tilting swivel chair with attached small table. "But we'll run the usual survey first." Morgan punched his fist into the seat cushion.
"Has anyone actually sat in it for 5 hours?" he asked.
"Yes, 100-kilo volunteer. No bedsores. If people complain, we'll remind them of the pioneering days of aviation when it took 5 hours merely to cross the Pacific. And of course we're offering low-G comfort almost all the way." The floor above was identical, though empty of chairs. They passed through it quickly and reached the next level, to which the designers had obviously devoted most attention. The bar looked almost functional, and the coffee dispenser was actually working. Above it, in an elaborate gilded frame, was an old engraving of such uncanny relevance that it took Morgan's breath away. A huge full moon dominated the upper left quadrant, and racing toward it was a bullet-shaped train towing 4 carriages. In the windows of the compartment labeled First Class, top-hatted Victorian personages could be seen admiring the view.
"Where did you get a hold of that?" Morgan asked in astonished admiration.
"Looks as if the caption's fallen off again," Kingsley said apologetically, hunting around behind the bar. "Ah, here it is." He handed Morgan a piece of card, upon which was printed in an old-fashioned typeface, "Projectile Trains for the Moon, engraving from the 1881 edition of From the Earth to the Moon, direct in 97 hours and 20 minutes, and A Trip Around It, by Jules Verne."
"I'm sorry to say I've never read it," Morgan commented when he had absorbed this information. "It might have saved me a lot of trouble, but I'd like to know how he managed without any rails."
"We shouldn't give Jules too much credit, or blame. This picture was never meant to be taken seriously. It was a joke of the artist."
"Well, give design my compliments. It's one of their better ideas."
Turning away from the dreams of the past, Morgan and Kingsley walked toward the reality of the future. Through the wide observation window, a back projection system gave a stunning view of Earth, and not just any view, Morgan was pleased to note, but the correct one. Tap Robbiny itself was hidden, of course, being directly below, but there was the whole subcontinent of Hindustan, right out to the dazzling snows of the Himalayas.
"You know," Morgan said, "it will be exactly like the bridge all over again. People will take the trip just for the view. Midway Station could be the biggest tourist attraction ever."
He glanced up at the azure-blue ceiling.
"Anything worth looking at on the last floor?"
"Not really. The upper airlock is planned, but we haven't decided where to put the life support backup gear and the electronics for the track centering controls."
"Any problems there?"
"Not with the new magnets. Powered or coasting, we can guarantee safe clearance up to 8,000 kilometers an hour, 50% above maximum design speed." Morgan permitted himself a mental sigh of relief. This was one area in which he was quite unable to make any judgments and had to rely completely on the advice of others. From the beginning, it had been obvious that only some form of magnetic propulsion could operate at such speeds. The slightest physical contact, at more than 1 kilometer a second, would result in disaster. And yet the 4 pairs of guidance slots running up the faces of the tower had only centimeters of clearance around the magnets. They had to be designed so that enormous restoring forces came instantly into play to correct any movement of the capsule away from the center line. As Morgan followed Kingsley down the spiral stairway that extended the full height of the mock-up, he was struck by a somber thought.
"I'm getting old," he said to himself. "Oh, I could have climbed to the 6th level without any trouble, but I'm glad we decided not to.
Yet I'm only 59, and it will be at least 5 years, even if all goes well, before the first passenger car rides up to Midway Station. Then another 3 years of tests, calibration, system tune-ups. Make it 10 years to be on the safe side." Though it was warm, he felt a sudden chill. For the first time, it occurred to Vannevar Morgan that the triumph upon which he had set his soul might come too late for him. And quite unconsciously, he pressed his hand against the slim metal disc concealed inside his shirt.
33. Cora.
"Why did you leave it until now?" Dr. Sen had asked, in a tone appropriate for a retarded child.
"The usual reason," Morgan answered as he ran his good thumb along the seal of his shirt. "I was too busy, and whenever I felt short of breath, I blamed it on the height."
"Altitude was partly to blame, of course. You'd better check all your people on the mountain. How could you have overlooked anything so obvious?"
"How indeed," thought Morgan, with some embarrassment. "All those monks, some of them were over 80. They seemed so healthy that it never occurred to me."
"The monks have lived up there for years. They're completely adapted. But you've been hopping up and down several times a day.
Twice at the most.
Going from sea level to half an atmosphere in a few minutes.
Well, there's no great harm done if you follow instructions from now on. Mine and Cora's."
"Cora's?"
"Coronary alarm."
"Oh, one of those things."
"Yes, one of those things. They save about 10 million lives a year. Mostly top civil servants, senior administrators, distinguished scientists, leading engineers, and similar nitwits. I often wonder if it's worth the trouble. Nature may be trying to tell us something, and we're not listening."
"Remember your Hippocratic oath, Bill," retorted Morgan with a grin. "And you must admit that I've always done just what you told me. Why, my weight hasn't changed a kilo in the last 10 years.
Well, you're not the worst of my patients," said the slightly mollified doctor. He fumbled around in his desk and produced a large holopad. "Take your choice. Here are the standard models. Any color you like, as long as it's medic red."
Morgan triggered the images and regarded them with distaste.
"Where do I have to carry the thing?" he asked. "Or do you want to implant it?"
"That isn't necessary, at least for the present. In 5 years, maybe, but perhaps not even then. I suggest you start with this model. It's worn just under the breastbone, so doesn't need remote sensors. After a while, you won't notice it's there, and it won't bother you unless it's needed."
"And then?"
"Listen."
The doctor threw one of the numerous switches on his desk console, and a sweet mezzo-soprano voice remarked in a conversational tone,
"I think you should sit down and rest for about 10 minutes.
After a brief pause, it continued,
"It would be a good idea to lie down for half an hour."
Another pause.
"As soon as convenient, make an appointment with Dr. Smith."
Then,
"Please take one of the red pills immediately." "I have called the ambulance. Just lie down and relax. Everything will be all right."
Morgan almost clapped his hands over his ears to cut out the piercing whistle.
"This is a Cora emergency. Will anyone within range of my voice please come immediately? This is a Cora emergency. Will—"
"I think you get the general idea," said the doctor, restoring silence to his office. "Of course, the programs and responses are individually tailored to the subject, and there's a wide range of voices, including some quite famous ones."
"That will do nicely. When will my unit be ready?"
"I'll call you in about 3 days. Oh, yes, there's an advantage of the chest-worn units I should mention."
"What's that?"
"One of my patients is a keen tennis player. He tells me that when he opens his shirt, the sight of that little red disc has an absolutely devastating effect on his opponent's game."
34. Vertigo.
There had once been a time when a minor, and often major, chore of every civilized man had been the regular updating of his address book. The universal code had made that unnecessary, since once a person's lifetime identity number was known, he could be located within seconds, and even if his number was not known, the standard search program could usually find it fairly quickly, given the approximate date of birth, his profession, and a few other details. There were, however, problems if the name was Smith, or Singh, or Mohammed. The development of global information systems had also rendered obsolete another annoying task. It was necessary only to make a special notation against the names of those friends one wished to greet on their birthdays or other anniversaries, and the household computer would do the rest. On the appropriate day, unless, as was frequently the case, there had been some stupid mistake in programming, the right message would be automatically flashed to its destination. And even though the recipient might shrewdly suspect that the warm words on his screen were entirely due to electronics, the nominal sender not having thought of him for years, the gesture was nevertheless welcome. But the same technology that had eliminated one set of tasks had created even more demanding successors. Of these, perhaps the most important was the design of the personal interest profile. Most men updated their PIP on New Year's Day or their birthday. Morgan's list contained 50 items. He had heard of people with hundreds. They must spend all their waking hours battling with the flood of information. Unless they were like those notorious pranksters who enjoyed setting up news alerts on their consoles for such classic improbabilities as eggs, dinosaur, hatching of, circle, squaring of, Atlantis, re-emergence of, Christ, second coming of, Loch Ness Monster, capture of, or, finally, world, end of. Usually, of course, egotism and professional requirements ensured that the subscriber's own name was the first item on every list. Morgan was no exception, but the entries that followed were slightly unusual. Tower, orbital. Tower, space. Tower, geosynchronous. Elevator, space. Elevator, orbital. Elevator, geosynchronous. These words covered most of the variations used by the media and ensured that he saw at least 90% of the news items concerning the project. The vast majority were trivial, and sometimes he wondered if it was worth searching for them. The ones that really mattered would reach him quickly enough. Morgan was still rubbing his eyes, and the bed had scarcely retracted itself into the wall of his modest apartment, when he noticed that the alert was flashing on his console. Punching the coffee and readout buttons simultaneously, he awaited the latest overnight sensation. "Orbital tower shot down," said the headline. "Follow up?" asked the console. "You bet," replied Morgan, now instantly awake. During the next few seconds, as he read the text display, his mood changed from incredulity to indignation, and then to concern. He switched the whole news package to Warren Kingsley with a "Please call me back as soon as possible" tag, and settled down to breakfast, fuming. Less than 5 minutes later, Kingsley appeared on the screen. "Well, Van," he said with humorous resignation, "we should consider ourselves lucky. It's taken him 5 years to get around to us."
"It's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. Should we ignore it? If we answer it, that will only give him publicity, which is just what he wants."
Kingsley nodded. "That would be the best policy, for the present. We shouldn't overreact. At the same time, he may have a point."
"What do you mean?"
Kingsley had become serious and even looked a little uncomfortable. "There are psychological problems as well as engineering ones," he said. "Think it over. I'll see you at the office." The image faded from the screen, leaving Morgan in a somewhat subdued frame of mind. He was used to criticism and knew how to handle it. Indeed, he thoroughly enjoyed the give and take of technical arguments with his peers and was seldom upset on those rare occasions when he lost. It was not so easy to cope with Donald Duck. That, of course, was not his real name, but Dr. Donald Bickerstaff's peculiar brand of indignant negativism often recalled that mythological 20th century character. His degree, adequate but not brilliant, was in pure mathematics. His assets were an impressive appearance, a mellifluous voice, and an unshakable belief in his ability to deliver judgments on any scientific subject. In his own field, he was quite good, Morgan remembered with pleasure an old-style public lecture by the doctor that he had once attended at the Royal Institution. For about a week afterward, he had almost understood the peculiar properties of transfinite numbers. Unfortunately, Bickerstaff did not know his limitations. Though he had a devoted coterie of fans who subscribed to his information service, in an earlier age he would have been called a pop scientist, he had an even larger circle of critics. The kinder ones considered that he had been educated beyond his intelligence. The others labeled him a self-employed idiot. It was a pity, thought Morgan, that Bickerstaff couldn't be locked in a room with Dr. Goldberg Parakama. They might annihilate each other like electron and positron, the genius of one canceling out the fundamental stupidity of the other. That unshakable stupidity against which, as Goethe lamented, the gods themselves contend in vain. No gods being currently available, Morgan knew that he would have to undertake the task himself. Though he had much better things to do with his time, it might provide some comic relief, and he had an inspiring precedent. There were few pictures in the hotel room that had been one of Morgan's four temporary homes for almost a decade. Most visitors could not believe that its components were all perfectly genuine. It was dominated by the graceful, beautifully restored steamship, ancestor of every vessel that could thereafter call itself modern. By her side, standing on the dock to which she had been miraculously returned a century and a quarter after her launch, was Dr. Vannevar Morgan. He was looking up at the scrollwork of the painted prow, and a few meters away, looking quizzically at him, was Isambard Kingdom Brunel, hands thrust in pockets, cigar clenched firmly in his mouth, and wearing a very rumpled, mud-spattered suit. Everything in the photo was quite real. Morgan had indeed been standing beside the Great Britain on a sunny day in Bristol the year after the Gibraltar Bridge was completed. But Brunel was back in 1857, still awaiting the launch of his later and more famous Leviathan, whose misfortunes were to break his body and spirit. The photograph had been presented to Morgan on his 50th birthday, and it was one of his most cherished possessions. His colleagues had intended it as a sympathetic joke, Morgan's admiration for the greatest engineer of the 19th century being well known. There were times, however, when he wondered if their choice was more appropriate than they realized. The Great Eastern had devoured her creator. The tower might yet do the same to him. Brunel had been surrounded by Donald Ducks. The most persistent was one Dr. Dionysus Lardner, who had proved beyond all doubt that no steamship could ever cross the Atlantic. An engineer could refute criticisms based on errors of fact or simple miscalculations, but the point that Donald Duck had raised was more subtle and not so easy to answer. Morgan recalled that his hero had to face something very similar 3 centuries ago. He reached toward his small but priceless collection of genuine books and pulled out the one he had read more often, perhaps, than any other. Rolt's classic biography, Isambard Kingdom Brunel. Leafing through the well-thumbed pages, he quickly found the item that had stirred his memory. Brunel had planned a railway tunnel almost 3 kilometers long. A monstrous and extraordinary, most dangerous and impracticable concept. It was inconceivable, said the critics, that human beings could tolerate the ordeal of hurtling through its Stygian depths. No person would desire to be shut out from daylight with a consciousness that he had superincumbent weight of earth sufficient to crush him in case of accident. The noise of 2 trains passing would shake the nerves. No passenger would be induced to go twice. It was all so familiar. The motto of the Lardners and the Bickerstaffs seemed to be, "Nothing shall be done for the first time." And yet, sometimes they were right, if only through the operation of the laws of chance. Donald Duck made it sound so reasonable. He had begun by saying, in a display of modesty, as unusual as it was spurious, that he would not presume to criticize the engineering aspects of the space elevator. He wanted to talk only about the psychological problems it would pose. They could be summed up in 1 word. Vertigo. The normal human being, he had pointed out, had a well-justified fear of high places. Only acrobats and tightrope artistes were immune to this natural reaction. The tallest structure on Earth was less than 5 kilometers high, and there were not many people who would care to be hauled vertically up the piers of the Gibraltar Bridge. Yet that was nothing compared to the appalling prospect of the orbital tower. "Who has not stood," Bickerstaff declaimed, "at the foot of some immense building, staring up at its sheer precipitous face until it seemed about to topple and fall? Now imagine such a building soaring on and on through the clouds, up into the blackness of space, through the ionosphere, past the orbits of all the great space stations, up and up until it reaches a large fraction of the way to the moon. An engineering triumph, no doubt, but a psychological nightmare. I suggest that some people will go mad at its mere contemplation. And how many could face the vertiginous ordeal of the ride, straight upward, hanging over the empty space for 25,000 kilometers to the first stop at the midway station? It is no answer to say that perfectly ordinary individuals can fly in spacecraft to the same altitude and far beyond. The situation then is completely different, as indeed it is in ordinary atmospheric flight. The normal man does not feel vertigo even in the open gondola of a balloon floating through the air a few kilometers above the ground. But put him at the edge of a cliff at the same altitude and study his reactions then. The reason for this difference is quite simple. In an aircraft, there is no physical connection linking the observer and the ground. Psychologically, therefore, he is completely detached from the hard, solid earth far below. Falling no longer has terrors for him. He can look down upon remote and tiny landscapes that he would never dare to contemplate from any high elevation. That saving physical detachment is precisely what the space elevator will lack. The hapless passenger, whisked up the sheer face of the gigantic tower, will be all too conscious of his link with Earth. What guarantee can there possibly be that anyone not drugged or anesthetized could survive such an experience? I challenge Dr. Morgan to answer.
Dr. Morgan was still thinking of answers, few of them polite, when the screen lit up again with an incoming call. When he pressed the accept button, he was not in the least surprised to see Maxine Duval.
"Well, Van," she said without any preamble, "what are you going to do?"
"I'm sorely tempted, but I don't think I should argue with that idiot. Incidentally, do you suppose that some aerospace organization has put him up to it?
My men are already digging. I'll let you know if they find anything. Personally, I feel it's all his own work. I recognize the hallmarks of the genuine article. But you haven't answered my question."
"I haven't decided. I'm still trying to digest my breakfast. What do you think I should do?"
"Simple. Arrange a demonstration. When can you fix it?"
"In 5 years, if all goes well."
"That's ridiculous. You've got your first cable in position."
"Not cable, tape."
"Don't quibble. What load can it carry?"
"Oh, at the Earth end, a mere 500 tons.
"There you are. Offer Donald Duck a ride."
"I wouldn't guarantee his safety."
"Would you guarantee mine?"
"You're not serious."
"I'm always serious at this hour of the morning. It's time I did another story on the tower anyway. That capsule mock-up is very pretty, but it doesn't do anything. My viewers like action, and so do I. The last time we met, you showed me drawings of those little cars the engineers will use to run up and down the cables. I mean, tapes. What did you call them?"
"Spiders."
"Ugh, that's right. I was fascinated by the idea. Here's something that has never been possible before by any technology. For the first time, you could sit still in the sky, even above the atmosphere, and watch the Earth beneath. Something that no spacecraft can ever do. I'd like to be the first to describe the sensation, and clip Donald Duck's wings at the same time."
Morgan waited for a full 5 seconds, staring Duval straight in the eyes, before he decided that she was perfectly serious.
"I can understand," he said rather wearily, "just how a poor, struggling young media girl, trying desperately to make a name for herself, would jump at such an opportunity. I don't want to blight a promising career, but the answer is definitely no."
The doyen of media people emitted several unladylike and even ungentlemanly words not commonly transmitted over public circuits. "Before I strangle you in your own hyperfilament van," she said, "why not?"
"Well, if anything went wrong, I'd never forgive myself."
"Spare the crocodile tears. Of course my untimely demise would be a major tragedy, for your project, but I wouldn't dream of going until you'd made all the tests necessary and were sure it was 100% safe."
"It would look too much like a stunt."
"As the Victorians, or was it the Elizabethans, used to say,
so what? Look, Maxine, there's a flash that New Zealand has just sunk. They'll need you in the studio. But thanks for the generous offer."
"Dr. Vannevar Morgan, I know exactly why you're turning me down. You want to be the first."
"As the Victorians used to say, so what?"
"Touché. But I'm warning you, Van, just as soon as you have one of those spiders working, you'll be hearing from me again." Morgan shook his head.
"Sorry, Maxine," he answered. "Not a chance."
35. Starglider plus 80. Extract from God and Starholm, Mandala Press, Moscow, 2149. Exactly 80 years ago, the robot interstellar probe now known as Starglider entered the solar system and conducted its brief but historic dialogue with the human race. For the first time, we knew what we had always suspected, that ours was not the only intelligence in the universe, and that out among the stars were far older and, perhaps, far wiser civilizations. After that encounter, nothing would ever be the same again. And yet, paradoxically, in many ways, little has changed. Mankind still goes about its business much as it has always done. How often do we stop to think that the Starholmers, back on their own planet, have already known of our existence for 28 years, or that almost certainly we will be receiving their first direct messages only 24 years from now? And what if, as some have suggested, they themselves are already on the way? Men have an extraordinary and perhaps fortunate ability to tune out of their consciousness the most awesome future possibilities. The Roman farmer, plowing the slopes of Vesuvius, gave no thought to the mountains smoking overhead. Half the 20th century lived with the hydrogen bomb, half the 21st with the Golgotha virus. We have learned to live with the threat or the promise of Starholm. Starglider showed us many strange worlds and races, but it revealed almost no advanced technology, and so had minimal impact upon the technically orientated aspects of our culture. Was this accidental, or the result of some deliberate policy? There are many questions one would like to ask Starglider now that it is too late, or too early. On the other hand, it did discuss many matters of philosophy and religion, and in these fields its influence was profound. Although the phrase nowhere occurs in the transcripts, Starglider is generally credited with the famous aphorism, "Belief in God is apparently a psychological artifact of mammalian reproduction." But what if this is true? It is totally irrelevant to the question of God's actual existence, as I shall now proceed to demonstrate. Swami Krishnamurti, Dr. Choam Goldberg. 36. The Cruel Sky. The eye could follow the tape much farther by night than by day, At sunset, when the warning lights were switched on, it became a thin band of incandescence, slowly dwindling away until, at some indefinite point, it was lost against the background of stars. Already, it was the greatest wonder of the world. Until Morgan put his foot down and restricted the sight to essential engineering staff, there was a continual flood of visitors. Pilgrims, someone had ironically called them, paying homage to the sacred mountain's last miracle. They would all behave in exactly the same way. First, they would reach out and gently touch the 5-centimeter-wide band, running their fingertips along it with something approaching reverence. Then they would listen, an ear pressed against the smooth, cold material of the ribbon, as if they hoped to catch the music of the spheres. There were some to have claimed to have heard a deep bass note at the uttermost threshold of audibility, but they were deluding themselves. Even the highest harmonics of the tape's natural frequency were far below the range of human hearing. And some would go away shaking their heads, saying, "You'll never get me to ride up that thing." But they were the type who had made similar remarks about the fusion rocket, the space shuttle, the airplane, the automobile, even the steam locomotive. To these skeptics, the usual answer was, "Don't worry, this is merely part of the scaffolding, one of the 4 tapes that will guide the tower down to Earth. Riding up the final structure will be exactly like taking an elevator in any high building, except that the trip will be longer and much more comfortable." Maxine Duval's trip, on the other hand, would be very short and not particularly comfortable. But once Morgan had capitulated, he had done his best to make sure that it would be uneventful. The flimsy Spider, a prototype test vehicle that looked like a motorized bosun's chair, had already made a 12 ascents to 20 kilometers, with twice the load it would be carrying now. There had been the usual minor teething problems, but nothing serious. The last 5 runs had been completely trouble-free. And what could go wrong? If there were a power failure, almost unthinkable in such a simple battery-operated system, gravity would bring Duval safely home, the automatic brakes limiting the speed of descent. The only real risk was that the drive mechanism might jam, trapping the Spider and its passenger in the upper atmosphere, and Morgan had an answer even for this. "Only 15 kilometers," Duval had protested. "A glider can do better than that."
"But you can't, with nothing more than an oxygen mask. Of course, if you'd like to wait a year until we have the operational unit with its life support system..."
"What's wrong with a spacesuit?"
Morgan had refused to budge, for his own good reasons. Though he hoped it would not be needed, a small jet crane was standing by at the foot of Sri Kanda. Its highly skilled operators were used to odd assignments. They would have no difficulty in rescuing a stranded Duval, even at an altitude of 20 kilometers. But there was no vehicle in existence that could reach her at twice that height. Above 40 kilometers was no man's land, too low for rockets, too high for balloons. In theory, a rocket could hover beside the tape for a very few minutes before it burned up all its propellant. But the problems of navigation and actual contact with the Spider were so horrendous that Morgan had not even bothered to think about them. It could never happen in real life, and he hoped that no producer of video drama would decide that there was good material here for a cliffhanger. That was the sort of publicity he could do without. Duval looked rather like a typical Antarctic tourist, as, glittering in her metal foil thermosuit, she walked toward the waiting Spider and the group of technicians around it. She had chosen the time carefully. The sun had risen only an hour ago, and its slanting rays would show the Taprobany landscape to best advantage. Her remote, even younger and huskier than the one used on the last memorable occasion, recorded the sequence of events for her system-wide audience. She had, as always, been thoroughly rehearsed. There was no fumbling or hesitation as she strapped herself in, pressed the battery charge button, took a deep draft of oxygen from her face mask, and checked the monitors on all her video and sound channels. Then, like a fighter pilot in some old historical movie, she signaled thumbs up and gently eased the speed control forward. There was a small burst of ironic clapping from the assembled engineers, most of whom had already taken joyrides up to heights of a few kilometers. Someone shouted, "Ignition! We have liftoff!" Moving about as swiftly as a brass birdcage elevator in the reign of Victoria I, the spider began its stately ascent.
"This must be like ballooning," Duval told herself. Smooth, effortless, silent. No, not completely silent. She could hear the gentle whir of the motors powering the multiple drive wheels that gripped the flat face of the tape. There was none of the sway or vibration that she had half expected. Despite its slimness, the incredible band she was climbing was as rigid as a bar of steel, and the vehicle's gyros were holding it rock steady. If she closed her eyes, she could easily imagine that she was already ascending the final tower. But she would not close her eyes. There was so much to see and absorb. There was even a good deal to hear. It was amazing how well sound carried. The conversations below were still quite audible. She waved to Morgan and looked for Kingsley. To her surprise, she was unable to find him. Though he had helped her aboard the spider, he had now vanished. Then she remembered his frank admission. Sometimes he made it sound almost like a wry boast, that the best structural engineer in the world couldn't stand heights. Everyone had some secret, or perhaps not so secret, fear. Duval did not appreciate spiders, and wished that the vehicle she was riding in had some other name. Yet she could handle one if it was really necessary. The creature she could never bear to touch, though she had met it often enough on her diving expeditions, was the shy and harmless octopus. The whole mountain was now visible, though from directly above it was impossible to appreciate its true height. The two ancient stairways winding up its face might have been oddly twisting level roads. Along their entire length, as far as she could observe, there was no sign of life. One section had been blocked by a fallen tree, as if nature had given advance notice after 3,000 years that she was about to reclaim her own. Leaving Camera 1 pointed downward, Duval started to pan with Number 2. Fields and forests drifted across the monitor screen, then the distant white domes of Ranapura, then the dark waters of the inland sea. And presently, there was Yakagala. She zoomed onto the rock and could just make out the faint pattern of the ruins covering the entire upper surface. The mirror wall was still in shadow, as was the gallery of the princesses, not that there was any hope of making them out from such a distance. But the layout of the pleasure gardens, with their ponds and walkways and massive surrounding moat, was clearly visible. The line of tiny white plumes puzzled her for a moment, until she realized that she was looking down upon another symbol of Kalidasa's challenge to the gods, his so-called Fountains of Paradise. She wondered what the king would have thought could he have seen her rising so effortlessly toward the heaven of his envious dreams. It was almost a year since she had spoken to Ambassador Rajasinghe. On a sudden impulse, she called the villa. "Hello, Johan," she greeted him. "How do you like this view of Yakagala?"
"So you've talked Morgan into it. How does it feel?"
"Exhilarating. That's the only word for it. And unique. I've flown and traveled in everything you can mention, but this feels quite different.
To ride secure the cruel sky."
"What was that?"
"An English poet, early 20th century. I care not if you bridge the seas or ride secure the cruel sky."
"Well, I care, and I'm feeling secure.
Now I can see the whole island, even the Hindustan coast.
How high am I, Van?"
"Coming up to 12 kilometers, Maxine. Is your oxygen mask on tight?"
"Confirmed. I hope it's not muffling my voice."
"Don't worry, you're still unmistakable. 3 kilometers to go."
"How much gas is left in the tank?"
"Sufficient, and if you try to go above 15, I'll use the override to bring you home."
"I wouldn't dream of it. And congratulations, by the way. This is an excellent observation platform. You may have customers standing in line."
"We've thought of that. The ComSat and MetSat people are already making bids. We can give them relays and sensors at any height they like. It will all help to pay the rent."
"I can see you!" exclaimed Raja Singh suddenly. Just caught your reflection in the scope. Now you're waving your arm. Aren't you lonely up there?
For a moment there was an uncharacteristic silence. Then Duval answered quietly,
Not as lonely as Yuri Gagarin must have been, 100 kilometers higher still.
Van, you have brought something new into the world. The sky may still be cruel, but you have tamed it. There may be some people who could never face this ride. I feel very sorry for them.
37. The Billion-Ton Diamond.
In the last 7 years, much had been done, yet there was so much to do. Mountains, or at least asteroids, had been moved. Earth now possessed a second natural moon, circling just above synchronous altitude. It was less than 1 kilometer across, and was rapidly becoming smaller as it was rifled of its carbon and other light elements. Whatever was left, the core of iron, tailings, and industrial slag, would form the counterweight that would keep the tower in tension. It would be the stone in the 40,000-kilometer-long sling that now turned with the planet once every 24 hours. 50 kilometers eastward of Ashoka Station floated the huge industrial complex that processed the weightless but not massless megatons of raw material and converted them into hyperfilament. Because the final product was more than 90% carbon, with its atoms arranged in a precise crystalline lattice, the tower had acquired the popular nickname the Billion-Ton Diamond. The Jewelers' Association of Amsterdam had sourly pointed out that A. hyperfilament wasn't diamond at all, and B. if it was, then the tower weighed 5 × 10^15 carats. Carats or tons, such enormous quantities of material had taxed to the utmost the resources of the space colonies and the skills of the orbital technicians. Into the automatic mines, production plants, and zero-gravity assembly systems had gone much of the engineering genius of the human race, painfully acquired during 200 years of spacefaring. Soon, all the components of the tower, a few standardized units manufactured by the million, would be gathered in huge floating stockpiles waiting for the robot handlers. Then the tower would grow in two opposite directions, down to Earth and simultaneously up to the orbital mass anchor, the whole process being adjusted so that it would always be in balance. Its cross-section would decrease steadily from orbit, where it would be under the maximum stress, down to Earth. It would also taper off toward the anchoring counterweight. When its task was complete, the entire construction complex would be launched into a transfer orbit to Mars. This was a part of the contract that had caused some heartburning among terrestrial politicians and financial experts now that, belatedly, the space elevator's potential was being realized. The Martians had driven a hard bargain. Though they would wait another 5 years before they had any return on their investment, they would then have a virtual construction monopoly for perhaps another decade. Morgan had a shrewd suspicion that the Pavonis Tower would merely be the first of several. Mars might have been designed as a location for space elevator systems, and its energetic occupants were not likely to miss such an opportunity. If they make their world the center of interplanetary commerce in the years ahead, good luck to them. Morgan had other problems to worry about, and some of them were still unsolved. The tower, for all its overwhelming size, was merely the support for something much more complex. Along each of its four sides must run 36,000 kilometers of track, capable of operating at speeds never before attempted. This had to be powered for its entire length by superconducting cables linked to massive fusion generators, the whole system being controlled by an incredibly elaborate, fail-safe computer network. The upper terminal, where passengers and freight would transfer between the tower and the spacecraft docked to it, was a major project in itself. So was Midway Station. So was Earth Terminal, now being lasered into the heart of the sacred mountain. And in addition to all this, there was Operation Cleanup.
For 200 years, satellites of all shapes and sizes, from loose nuts and bolts to entire space villages, had been accumulating in Earth orbit. All that came below the extreme elevation of the tower at any time now had to be accounted for, since they created a possible hazard. 3/4 of this material was abandoned junk, much of it long forgotten. Now it had to be located and somehow disposed of. Fortunately, the old orbital forts were superbly equipped for this task. Their radars, designed to locate oncoming missiles at extreme ranges with no advance warning, could easily pinpoint the debris of the early space age. Then their lasers vaporized the smaller satellites, while the larger ones were nudged into higher and harmless orbits. Some, of historic interest, were recovered and brought back to Earth. During this operation, there were quite a few surprises. For example, 3 Chinese astronauts who had perished on some secret mission, and several reconnaissance satellites constructed from such an ingenious mix of components that it was quite impossible to discover what country had launched them. Not that it now mattered a great deal, since they were at least 100 years old. The multitude of active satellites and space stations, forced for operational reasons to remain close to Earth, all had to have their orbits carefully checked and in some cases modified. But nothing could be done about the random and unpredictable visitors that might arrive at any time from the outer reaches of the solar system. Like all the creations of mankind, the tower would be exposed to meteorites. Several times a day, its network of seismometers would detect milligram impacts, and once or twice a year, minor structural damage could be expected. Sooner or later, during the centuries to come, it might encounter a giant that could put one or more tracks out of action for a while. In the worst possible case, the tower might even be severed somewhere along its length. That was about as likely to happen as the impact of a large meteorite upon London or Tokyo, which presented roughly the same target area. The inhabitants of those cities did not lose much sleep worrying over this possibility. Nor did Vannevar Morgan. Whatever problems might lie ahead, no one doubted now that the orbital tower was an idea whose time had come.